So yesterday we were practicing positive emotion supported by spiritual receptivity. Today we're practicing positive emotion completely unsupported. Going beyond needing any support at all. And today's our last day, so we'll be coming out of silence once we're away from the lunch area. Yeah, so not when you've finished your lunch. Not that you start talking to people around you when other people are still coming in. Once we're away from that dining area, we're out of silence. And you can, the program's on the notice board. This afternoon at 4 o'clock, we'll be going back into the groups that we were in at the beginning, in the rooms that we were in at the beginning, if you can remember that far back. So, the shrine continues to evolve and transform in magical ways. And this aura of positive emotion around the Buddha is fantastic. One thing I wanted to mention is that there's a photo and the name of Abhaya Prabha, who's an Indian Dhammachari who died yesterday. He came from Maharashtra, a village in Maharashtra, and he was 57 years old. He'd been ill for some time. So we could just, at some point, just bear him in mind. So this morning, we'll start, as we have been, with some practice, and which we'll do a mantra and then guided meditation as usual. Hard to tell, but it might be about half an hour. Let's see. And this morning we'll do the White Tara mantra for Bhante. These days, I don't quite think of it as the mantra for Bhante's long life, because I don't want him to just keep on. I don't want to keep on sort of keep him here at all costs, as it were. But in the mantra, we wish him ayur, punya, and jnana. So may his. And ayur means, it's more like sort of vitality, it's more like life energy, actually. So, yes, we can wish him, if you like, that kind of quality of life that comes from, you know, having the energy to enjoy and respond to life. And thankfully, I gather, you know, Bhante's energy has sort of picked up quite a bit, certainly, compared to this time last year. Yeah, he still seems to have the energy to interfere in things in all sorts of ways when he feels like it. So long may that continue. So we wish him vitality, merits, and wisdom. And while that's happening, the Dhammadasan is going to lead that mantra for us. And while that's going on, Kalyanavacha will make an offering on behalf of all of us. An offering of gratitude to our teachers. An offering of receptivity to Amitabha, Avalokiteshvara, Tara, and to all the qualities that they embody, that we really take them in and through us they have an influence on the world. So we'll just sit quietly for a minute or two and then the mantra.
Pushtin Kuru Swaha. Bhante Ayu Punyanyana Pushtin Kuru Swaha Om Tare Tutare Ture Bhante Ayu Punyanyana Pushtin Kuru Swaha Om Tare Tutare Ture Bhante Ayu Punyanyana Pushtin Kuru Swaha Om Tare Tutare Ture Bhante Ayu Punyanyana Pushtin Kuru Swaha
Letting the mantra dissolve into silence in our heart. And just sitting for a minute or two with the effects. Now, as we're sitting, making sure we're well rooted, as if the body's growing out of the earth. Drawing on all the stability, all the equanimity of the earth. Drawing on that sense of stability and equanimity, we bring awareness up into the body, becoming aware of the sensations and the feelings. They come and go. And letting that awareness be kindly, caring, nourishing. Now being particularly aware of the breathing, the out-breath, letting go of Kleon, letting the out-breath be generous, let it be a sharing with life. not holding back. Letting the in-breath be a full receiving. Grateful, appreciating the gift of the breath, the gift of life. Not closing down, not shutting things out. Available to life. Breathing in, breathing out in this way. Acknowledging that we are life. To help us open to life even more, being aware of the deep resources feeling, sensing, imagining the presence of a refuge in our heart. Now with each in-breath, all our tensions, anxieties, fears, frustration, and so on. All just dissolve into the refuge in our heart. And with the out-breath, There's love. There's support. There's encouragement. Whatever we need. This sense widens out to all of us practicing here together. With each in-breath, relieving suffering and the causes of suffering, all dissolving into the refuge. And with each out-breath, sending love, sending resources, whatever's helpful, whatever's of benefit, whatever's needed. So we're all part of one practice. Now let's widen things out. Aware of more beings. However we want to do that, however individuals come to mind, or just widening out with a sense of more and more space, including more and more. Just for a little while. still all part of one practice. Feeling the support of all those around us. For a minute or two, let's go as wide as possible, right to our mental horizon, wherever that is, wherever we can imagine beings, all those living now, all those to come, like all those beings who will inherit this planet from us, from our generation. Dissolving away suffering and its causes. And with each out-breath from the refuge, all the causes of happiness, all the causes of freedom. Now, let's let go of any sense of doing anything. Let's just sit with that, keeping that sense of openness, of spaciousness. Pervaded with compassion, with love, with care. You want to just keep the sense of the refuge in your heart. So you're sitting in the presence of the refuge. If you're identified with anything at all, it's just that open space of loving awareness. And finally, let's dedicate the benefits of the practice to all beings everywhere. So that meditation was a little bit of revision. It was touching back onto some of the themes and ways of practicing that we've looked at over the last few days. So we are starting to come towards the end. And coming towards the end of the retreat is sometimes a good opportunity to catch any tendency that you have to a kind of horrified anxiety about leaving. Maybe horrified is a bit strong, but it's good to, under good conditions, just watch how your mind kind of constructs feelings of concern. Might say a bit more about that in a minute. When I was on long retreat with Vijayamala, we were guided by this German Tibetan Lama, Lama Tilman, and he'd come and see us. Well, it varied, but on average, probably every 2-3 weeks. And he'd spend hours. And we'd go into great detail about our practice and what's been going on, and he'd give us advice, and we'd very often study a text, and because he was there for hours, we'd also eat, and he'd talk about what was going on with him. He was very open. But he said he never wanted to leave until he'd hoovered up all our Dharma questions. Now, I've got about 24 Dharma questions that I haven't answered. And I don't think I'm going to be able to hoover up all of them. Some of them, probably the moment has passed. I'm really sorry that I can't just respond to questions as they're there. But I am going to spend a bit of this session just looking at a few of the things that are here. I feel slightly wary about it in a way, because quite often, you know, when you're talking about Dharma things, it's a question of kind of balance, and you need to stress this, but if you just stress this, then people take it one-sidedly, and so it's difficult. But what I'm going to try and do is just talk about some of them, see if I can for once restrain myself a bit and just do a few headlines for some of them. I was quoting our team meeting the other night, something Voltaire said, which is, the secret of being a bore is to say everything. Okay, let's see what we can start with. Any thoughts on working with guilt? Guilt. I mentioned the other day I was brought up a Roman Catholic, so I don't know anything about guilt. I have in my over the years I sort of did have a period where I had to work very intensively with working with guilt. So first off, we need to separate out guilt and rational remorse. Yeah? There's a natural feeling of remorse when we've done something which has caused harm to ourselves or others. And yeah, we need to really open to that. And when we come on retreat, often we feel a certain amount of remorse in some way or another. And that's a really good thing. But that's different from irrational guilt, which is a really unhelpful state. I found working... Bhante has a sort of definition of irrational guilt. It's in the spiritual significance of confession talk that he gave as part of the Sutra of Golden Light series, which is all about, actually, when you examine that irrational guilt, there's a fear of losing the love or affection of someone or some people or God or whoever it may be, whose affection and love you need. And looking into my sense of guilt, I found that really, really helpful. And for about a year, I kept just checking, you know, when I was feeling guilty, was this rational remorse? Was this irrational guilt? Was it that I was fearing, you know, was I all caught up in the worldly winds of praise and blame? Yeah. So there's some kind of unhelpful mechanism going on there. I also found Bhante's comments about the point of freedom really helpful. There's a couple of passages in the Milarepa and the Yakholm seminar where I mentioned earlier in the week, where he talks about, as a Dharma practitioner, you know, you have to feel that you're operating from a point of freedom. So if you're feeling constrained, pressured, you know, whether you've taken that pressure on from outside or whether it's there, you know, the first thing that you have to do, and your spiritual friends have to help you do, is re-establish that. So I kept checking whether I actually felt a point of freedom in my practice or not, or whether I felt, you know, constrained to do things out of a sense of guilt. And so all that really helped.
What do you mean by point of freedom in your practice?
What do I mean by a point of freedom? I mean simply that you feel free to act in whatever way feels best and right to you. Just that, in a way. Yeah. That's what I mean by a point of freedom. So with guilt, you don't feel free to act in any way. It's like you don't feel like you have choice, actually. You know, you've got to act in a certain way because... So very often underneath that irrational guilt, there's a resentment of having to act in a certain way, of feeling like, oh, I've got, you know, I must do such and such. And it's good to tap into that underlying kind of resentment because it's an attempt of your psyche to kind of throw off that what you've taken on, that you're imposing on yourself. So you can often kind of catch again, guilt sort of drives you. So there's no sense of freedom. So in order to practice the Dharma, you have to really feel free not to practice the Dharma. For instance. Yes, just little highlights. We could spend a few days on that one. You talked about faith. What to do if it's not there? How to connect with a deeper faith? People have faith. I think we're all different. We respond in slightly different ways. Our bases of faith vary. I mentioned, that it's important to sort of feed your faith, to nourish your sense of confidence. And that partly comes out of as much as possible sort of putting yourself in good conditions. Over the years, I found it really helpful to take in inspiring examples. So I just keep reflecting on the people that I do have faith in. People that I am confident are freer than me, more relaxed than me, clearer and wiser than me, more open-hearted than me. Those people that I'm in contact with. And also just examples from the past, whether it's reading about the Buddha or reading about teachers and practitioners of the past, or not just of the past, even of the present, reading the life of somebody like Dipama. The very kind of ordinary Indian woman who became really extraordinary. Or some of the forest practitioners from very recent times, again, living extraordinary lives, practicing the Dharma and in the jungle, having meetings with tigers. I find all that very inspiring. And then it does help just to make sure that you are keeping some kind of Dharma input going. Doesn't have to be very much. Yes, we can study the Dharma to know more and to be more helpful to other people, to teach classes and all that kind of thing. But just to take in just small amount of Dharma and take it in deeply, just to read, just have a Dharma text that you sit down with, something quite simple, at the beginning or an end, at the beginning, say, of a meditation. And you just start to read. And maybe you just read until there's a verse or a little sentence that just hits you. And then you don't read anymore. You just take that in. You just let that really sink in. Because in a way, faith, again, it comes out of sort of listening, reflecting and meditating. It has to be. When we find something that we do have confidence in that inspires us, we really need to make the most of that. I think very often I used to just, I'd read something and be inspired for 5 minutes, and then it would sort of tail off, and I'd carry on until I met something else, and that would inspire me for a little bit. Some people I know have just taken, one piece of Dharma or one meeting with Bhante or something like that, and that's, they've just taken that deeper and deeper and deeper and seen the implications of it and just taken it into their hearts. So the bases of faith are always said to be reason, intuition and experience, aren't they? So we can be working in all those ways. And it's very important, something else that I've done a lot over the years is just being clear with the Dharma. It's almost like, well, what do I really know in my experience? What can I be really sure of? It's like in my early years of practice, I'd kind of take on a whole lot of teaching and practice. And then every now and again, I'd just kind of look at it to see, well, what can I really rely on? What have I really made my own? What am I sure of? And most of it would just all sort of fall away. But I'd be left with, well, I do believe in awareness, and I do believe in love. Let's not call it metta. You know, I believe in love. And I'd sort of come back to those, and they were like sort of foundations, and I knew them. They were. I had faith in those. I had confidence in those. And then, okay, I'd take in some more Dharma. And then again, at a certain point, I just test out, well, what do I really know? And yes, I believe in awareness, and I believe in, well, yeah, all right, we can call it metta. And yeah, I know that everything changes. And I'd sort of come back to that. So we have a sense of what we really have experienced, what makes sense to us, and what intuitively feels right to us. And we're sort of clear about where we stand with those things. And we just build from there. So this is going to be very bitty, but I think, how can positive emotion counteract deep existential fear felt just physically in the tummy, in the stomach? Yeah. How can positive emotion counteract deep existential fear felt just physically in the tummy? Quite often, as you go deeper into your practice, as you start to realize that you don't control things in the way that you're desperately trying to, that life is far more mysterious than you imagine, that it doesn't just all fit into your categories and ideas. As you get to that point of sort of coming to the edge of being what you think of as you and thinking about leaping off into something much bigger and broader, into much deeper positive emotion. Yeah, very often there's fear, there's deep fear, and that's a really common experience. It's something that happens. I know Bhante's talked about it in his practice. I think it's pretty universal. And that kind of fear, well, again, you know, as with anything, you do your best to hold it with kindness, with metta, and you call on your spiritual friends. And it's really helpful, particularly, again, if you can be in touch with someone, either directly or indirectly, who's sort of been through that stage, yeah, who's sort of gone more deeply into insight territory than you have, who's like let go into that much kind of wider, more open way of being beyond selfing, because they can encourage and inspire us. And also we can see, well, actually, yes, spiritual death does lead to spiritual rebirth. I may not be liking the look of the next step of my spiritual life. In fact, you know, do I have to? But then we see other people who we feel, well, they must have gone. We know they've gone through that step. And, well, yes, I look at those people and I think, well, they're still here. They haven't just disappeared into the voidness. And they're much friendlier, happier, more relaxed, more spontaneous than I am. Yeah. So that kind of encourages me to think, okay, deep breath, here we go. I'll give it a go. But even the other side of that kind of experience, still, like the results of all that past selfing, all that clenching and tightening and closing around, you know, am I going to be all right? And is this okay? And all that just has left its effects on your physical being. So quite a lot of the work sort of post some kind of insight, is just really working to relax and let go those deep sort of physical tensions and those sort of subtle energetic blockages. And that goes on and on, really. That doing that, maybe it's in your stomach, there's still, okay, you know there's no one to be worried about, there's no one to die, and yet, you know, if you're suddenly taken seriously ill, your body may still kind of go into your body is doing it, even though you're not, you know, mentally you're not believing the story of, you know, there's a me that's going to die and this is all a terrible tragedy. There's a whole sort of further stage of the path where you're just working with those sort of deeper sort of physical holdings and reactions. And a lot of that is about, you know, is just holding those things with metta, just again and again and again and again. Just, and they do gradually relax and unfold. And just really working with a whole, working with relaxation as much as possible. And if it is in this sort of area, you can sort of breathe down below the navel in a very sort of relaxed kind of way. There's a whole sort of practice in the Tibetan tradition which I sometimes teach on this sort of retreat. Okay. Hi, Vasantra. Hi. This morning I heard you say, what we get out of our practice is influenced by our views. Can you expand on that more? The difficulty for me lies in not knowing what my underlying views are. Blind as a bat. That's what we're like, you know. It's like it's the first, you know, in the 12 Nidanas, there's the blind man with a stick. We're all a bit blind, particularly to our own, how we are, because we're so close up to ourselves, which is why spiritual friends are so important. What we get out of our practice is influenced by our views, in the sense that the story we're telling ourselves holds back the momentum of the practice. Yeah, the practice may finally break through it, but views, although they're nothing, they're just words in our head, they do... they're also extraordinarily effective in blocking us from being freer. Yeah. So, yeah, if I believe that, you know, I'm not a meditator, then, you know, that's going to have an effect on how I meditate. If I have a sort of subtle sort of sense that, well, actually, there is something terribly the matter with me, and I don't know what it was that I did, but, you know, somehow there is, I really am the worst person in the world, that I don't deserve to be free or to be happy or to be serene. All that will have an effect. Yeah. So we have to sort of dig around at what our views are, and the views go very deep. We're making all kinds of assumptions about the world. We're putting concepts onto our world, and they go right down to basic things about time and space and one and many, self and other. But just on a more everyday level, very often what I do is I just watch, I'm practicing, and I just watch where there's tension. And where there's tension, I just try to see if there's some assumption that I'm going on. There's some kind of story that I'm telling myself about what's happening. In a way, a view is just a story that we're telling ourselves. We love telling ourselves stories. We're human beings. We're storytelling animals. We tell ourselves the story of me, our entire lives. Yeah. Yeah. So what sort of a story are we telling ourselves? And through doing that and, exploring with other people, which is really helpful because they tend to have slightly different views, so that helps us notice, oh, right, you're seeing it like that. You thought you were the worst person in the world. But there can't be two of us, so what does that mean? You know, so that view that I have is a view. It's not how things are. It's just, oh, right. Yeah, so exploring with other people really helps. But this is really important for our practice. We have to be looking at the assumptions. We have to be looking at the stories we're telling ourselves. And, just pick whatever thread of view you can find, Just what sort of things do you say to yourself? What sort of person do you think you are? Start from there and just keep exploring. Try and do a couple very quickly. Is all tension connected to selfing? I'd say 99.95% of tension is connected to selfing. Yeah, maybe there's some just pure physical tension where, if you're one of those ascetics at the time of the Buddha and you stood with one hand in the air, eventually, there would be tension whether or not you were selfing about it. The muscles in your arm eventually would...
You'd only do that if you had an idea of...
Absolutely, yeah, you would only do that if you had an idea of a self, it's true. But far more than we realise, tension is connected to referring back to me. So it's like, I remember Tillman, our retreat guide, saying that even if, somebody in here was suddenly to kind of let off a pistol or something, so this is really loud... you think, well, it's natural, you kind of jump. But he said, he knew practitioners who just wouldn't, because even that is related back immediately on a very, very subtle, very fast level to what's happening to me? What's happening to my environment that's suddenly made it very unsafe? Am I all right? So... yeah. Tension connects back to suffering, to selfing. One more, then we have a break. How can we respond to suffering in the world which our government is implicated in? Without getting angry. Again, this is one of these questions... Maybe I'll just take all these questions away and write hour-long talks about them all. Firstly, we need to recognise that our government consists, just as I was saying the other day about parents, we feel like, our parents really could have acted very differently. They could have treated us far better than they did. But actually they were so conditioned. And they were, they had their own craving and aversion and ignorance and their own suffering. And so they just did their best. So one can feel angry, our government, these people, they've put themselves up for election and they've taken on this power and they're using it so badly. But it's just more craving, hatred and ignorance. It's just more conditioning. So if you want to feel angry about the fact that everything's conditioned, well, feel free. But we can't really, in a sense, expect anything very different. The whole of history, when I read it, is just the history of craving, aversion and delusion, playing itself out in all kinds of ways. So maybe that sort of reflection helps us to yeah, not to get too angry about things. And we still do whatever we can do about the suffering in the world, whether we decide to act in some political way or not. But yeah, the government can see, unfortunately, well, there's that saying, you know, whoever you voted for, the government got in. whoever you voted for, you know, some degree of craving, aversion, and delusion got in. So we have to work with that as best we can. And we can, yes, we can be engaged politically and try and see that the people who represent us supposedly, you know, are as good as possible. But yeah, still, they're going to be acting under conditions. All right, let's have 20. Let's try and be back here at 12:05. How about that? Okay, let's do a few more questions and then we'll have a short meditation. Maybe I'll do this one because it's on a big piece of paper and it's covering over all the others. This is written by Confused. Could be any of us, couldn't it? I'm confused about metta. Is metta a feeling? Is metta karma or vipaka? Can metta be generated? Surely not. The way I was taught the metta bhavana, or maybe the way I thought I was taught it, was as if metta was a feeling, could be generated, and was an action. And that maybe relates also to how we teach metta as well. I feel, again, I could say a lot about all this. I'm also very aware I've got a lot of people in this room who certainly, you know, have led a lot of retreats on metta, have taught endless beginners classes on metta, far more than me these days. But seeing as I'm the one who's sitting up here, I'll say what I think. So, metta is fundamentally a karma, it's a volition. It's something active. So it's not a vipaka. One of the vipakas of metta is that it becomes easier to produce more karmas, more volitions of metta, the more you do. Some of the vipakas of metta, you get lists, you know, of the benefits and the effects of metta, like, the person who practices metta sleeps well, for instance. Although I don't think that necessarily means that if you're not sleeping well, it may not be your lack of metta, it may just be that loud snorer opposite or whatever. Metta is a volition, it's an activity, you can say, of mind. Although as time goes on, it may not feel as if you're really kind of doing anything very much most of the time. As it becomes more natural, you may not feel as if, you know, you are making some, you know, there's this metta happening in a sense of something that you're doing. As time goes on, it becomes sort of more natural and more spontaneous. And in teaching metta, it's important that we are clear about the difference between hedonic feeling and volition. Yeah, so it's like I've sometimes, years ago, I've sat in classes where somebody's taught the metta bhavana, and they've said, well, imagine yourself and a good friend, and you're sitting on a beach on a wonderful sunny day, and you're both feeling really happy, and you're both enjoying the sound of the waves. And it's sort of kind of stopped there a bit. Now, all that's kind of helping to generate conditions maybe for metta. Yeah, it's like it's helping you into a sense of relaxation, sense of openness. All that sun on that beach is, you know, kind of helping you to open out. But there isn't any kind of necessarily any well-wishing in it. There isn't any, out of it doesn't necessarily come, you know, out of it may just come a desire to kind of go on holiday with your friend. Which in itself, you know, isn't necessarily an expression of metta. Yeah. There are lots of things which help set up the conditions, and it's really important, you know, if you're teaching metta, to set up those conditions. But they aren't in itself metta. As even empathy, I don't think in itself. And I think empathy, you know, tends to produce metta, but it doesn't. It in itself, it isn't necessarily metta full. I mean, there are people out there who are working to empathise with us for, you know, just so that they can then sell us things. Yeah. So it's not that. We have to be clear that, metta is a well-wishing, fundamentally. It's a love and care which tends to express itself in words and actions. I mean, the expressing in words and actions may be quite a long way behind, you know, our mental, what happens in our minds. You know, there's often a gap. You start practicing metta and, you know, for quite a while you may be sitting there feeling metta, full in meditation, and then coming out and, you know, you're back being Mr. or Mrs. Grumpy Bear over breakfast. But the tendency is for that metta to want to express itself, you know, to make a difference, to be more caring to yourself and others. And we talk about metta as an emotion and a feeling because quite often we feel, you know, there can be quite a strong sort of heart feeling with it. But sometimes metta can be there and there's no sort of strong kind of emotional feeling. It's a bit like Bhante talks about puja sometimes. He says you may sit through, you know, be in a sevenfold puja, and you may not feel, you know, deeply moved and inspired and so on. But it's a bit more like at the end of the puja, you feel as if you've had the spiritual equivalent of a kind of a good meal, you know, like sort of, but it's something really healthy, you know, sort of like you've just had some really good rice and vegetables, if you know what I mean. There's that sense of, yes, something has happened which you feel like, oh, yes, that's been really satisfying sort of spiritually on some level, but you may not have been very kind of up and down on an emotional level. And metta can be like that. It's not necessarily that you feel a big kind of surge from your heart chakra. You may well do, but fundamentally what we're looking for is this sense of well-wishing, of opening, turning towards, and there's a feeling there that's nourishing, that's nurturing, that's there to help, that's there, that wants the best, and is increasingly, you know, acting in that, behind that feeling, behind that volition. So, in teaching metta to beginners, they are likely, although who knows who's going to walk through the door, they may be somebody quite far down the path. We have to be open to that possibility. But most people are not going to be that self-aware. They're going to have a strong belief in self. And personally, I would still, in a gentle kind of way, encourage them to develop, generate metta. May they be well. May they be happy. But it's so easy for that then to become sort of, to go onto automatic, to be something which doesn't tend to deepening into experience. And so I think we need to be aiming to set up, to put the conditions in place first off, even though they're not metta in themselves, which will allow metta to arise. So I think there has to be a lot of skillfulness going into helping people to relax, helping people to feel their way into some appreciation, helping them to empathize, and helping them to be at least a little bit more open and available to life and to their experience, which is going to mean, you know, their experience is going to be both pleasant and painful, and to life around them. So none of that in itself is metta per se, but all that just sets up the conditions so that it's much easier for a what we can call a more natural, you know, unforced, unwilled, unpushed, undriven metta to arise, yeah, which is what we want. Yeah. Just really encouraging people to develop awareness. Now it's like if you're with a good friend, you can start off thinking, may they be well, may they be happy. But if you just really take them in, there you are. There's this other person, and they're like this, and you know, just in a gentle kind of way. Out of that, it only takes a little kind of movement of mind for that to go into metta. Yeah. If I'm sitting down with somebody and I haven't really taken them in, and basically they're still a concept for me and a sort of cardboard cutout, then I have to kind of get the crank out and start, you know, winding and winding instead. So yeah, I think for beginners and new people, we have to be thinking in terms of them developing and producing, getting something going, but really in all sorts of skillful ways, setting up the conditions so that, yeah, it comes as naturally as possible. And it also helps if we can really get people to see that actually they do experience positive emotion and care. You know, it's like, if they hear about some disaster in the world, unless they're, you know, if they're too busy, too caught up in themselves, okay, they won't be able to respond. But actually still, in nearly everyone who comes through the door of the Buddhist Center, yeah, if they hear about, you know, there's been an avalanche, there's been an earthquake, the natural response to that is, oh. If they hear that someone has died, their natural response is, oh. And what's that? That, oh, is just, they have a good human heart in there that responds even to people that they've never met, people on the other side of the world. There's a feeling. There's a feeling of care, a feeling response. So just helping people to tap into that there is some sort of human goodness that they have, yeah, underneath all their concerns about themselves and their lack of confidence and so on and so forth, that also helps. So part of what we're doing when we're teaching metta is just giving people confidence, confidence in their own heart mind, confidence in their responsiveness. Yeah. Because it's when we don't have confidence in that then we just try terribly hard instead. Yeah. And you know, we just push and push and then that has all the effects that we know about. So you're saying that first, I'm just repeating because I'm not sure everyone can hear or the recorder can hear. So yes, for a lot of people, metta in the sense of universal loving kindness can feel like a very big leap. And so, yeah, and that's true. Although again, I wouldn't want to sort of leave them out, if you know what I mean. I think constantly we have to, if we're teaching, if we're practicing for ourselves, again, we need to be aware that, you know, we're this sort of spread out race of people. So it's like even with new people, I always would mention, you know, even if I feel like they're all basically just come to become a bit more relaxed and calm, I'll always mention something about where the Buddhist path goes to, because something in them may respond to that. And also I don't want, you know, somebody who does come through the doors of a Buddhist center actually with a real existential quest on to feel like they've come to the wrong place. That would be terrible. So, even if just part of us is kind of getting a bit of a vision, okay, we have to make sure that we don't in any way, in the way that we teach, set up some kind of sense of expectation that people will experience this great, you know, oceanic feeling of love, and if they didn't, you know, they're not a meditator and all that. But yeah, you know, we can sort of evoke something of that, because even that does help to expand things. But then, yeah, we need to have a real sense of also helping people come right to, you know, their own experience right now, which means also, you know, teaching them to really connect with their body, with the earth, and just to, mainly just to learn to kind of turn towards their experience, whatever it is, and to realize that the you know, what's important is the metaphor attitude that they're having to their experience, rather than, you know, whether their experience is a blissful one or a bored one or whatever. Just doing that work, you know, just that tiny, careful attending to experience, moment by moment, just getting them, beginning to get them into that. You know, that's the, in a way, yes, that for me, that's kind of the counterbalance to the, you know, what can all sound very cosmic. So we'll draw a rather arbitrary line under that and those questions. There's lots more, obviously, we could say.